This is an interview with Carl W. Thompson for the State Historical Society of Wisconsin. The interview was conducted on September 22, 1981 by Mark W. Smith.
Okay, why don't we start off about the organization of Phil LaFollette's office and how Phil LaFollette ran his office when he was governor during your time there.
Gwynne? Yeah. Well, Phil LaFollette's personal secretary was Mabel Griswold. And Mabel Griswold handled all of his correspondence. That is not to say she took all the dictation, but she was sort of in charge of that aspect of things. And Charlie Dow was his, I think he was called personal secretary. But he was sort of the official greeter. Everybody who came to the governor's office would be interviewed by Charlie Dow. Charlie was an older person, and so forth. A fellow named Zaratsky from, I think, La Crosse, who was a mail order specialist, was his guy for communicating with people. And when they would send out letters, they would send out thousands and thousands of letters, and they were the originators of sending a letter, for example, to all the preachers, and another letter to all the business people, and another letter to all the teachers, and so forth. And Zaratsky used the techniques of mail order selling for him. Do you want me to give a little instance?
Yeah.
Phil LaFollette and Bob LaFollette went to Washington one time to see Franklin Roosevelt, and Phil told, I think Zaratsky was along, and they told Franklin Roosevelt about it, and Franklin thought this was a great idea, and he got someone to do it, and the people were so stupid the person who was in charge of the project just used practically the same letter, or maybe the same letter, that Phil LaFollette was used, and they sent it back to Wisconsin, and here they found a letter from Phil LaFollette, one from Franklin Roosevelt, which was almost identical, or maybe identical, I'm not sure. The other secretary was Tommy Duncan, who was the former socialist, former member of the state senate, and one of the brightest men I've ever run into. Extremely able guy. And then Gordon Sinekin was the legal secretary. Did you get the names of the people on the staff from Gordon?
Or? Yes, quite a few of them. Yeah. Uh-huh. I wonder if you could give me maybe a little more impression of Tommy Duncan, because he's a very elusive figure to find out about these days.
Well, he was sort of the political guy or the legislative guy, and he did the planning on how to get through the programs, well, through the legislature, and it was sort of the contact guy with the legislature. You remember that what happened was that Phil and Gordon, or Phil and Tom Duncan, were driving in Milwaukee, and they hit a man and killed a person. And I can't remember if Tom was convicted of drinking and driving, or
there was a manslaughter,
charge brought against him. Was it a conviction?
Yes, he served some time and then was pardoned by Phil in December of 1938.
I see.
Mm-hmm. But in many ways, Duncan is looked on as somewhat of an evil genius by people who look at the legislative side, and yet there are others who think he was a hero. And so I'm just interested in more personal characteristics and his method of operating.
Well, at that time, you know, I was a file clerk along with Cliff Pulvermacher, who I believe is down in Indiana someplace. No, he's up in Upper Michigan now. He's a brother of Marie Pulvermacher with the Capital Times. And Pete Morrissey, who's now a judge in Walworth County, or was a judge in Walworth County. So we really didn't get on the inside as much as others did, because we were so darn busy trying to untangle where we'd file letters and so forth. And My recollection of Tom was as an extremely intelligent, very... He was very good at untangling the webs that would be drawn by the opposition. And they boycotted one of the sessions of the legislature. Did you hear discussion of that? And when he proposed that they put all the bills together and try and pass them all on one motion before the other people could come back, but that never flew. It was thought about, though. I think Tommy thought about that idea. And whether he was serious about it or not, I don't know.
Okay. The other thing I wondered, if you traveled much with Phil as a campaigner, or if you were on the campaign trail at all.
Most of the driving I did was with, I drove Eisen, his wife. And he had a regular chauffeur. I ran into the chauffeur in recent years, and I can't remember even what his name was. But he had a regular professional chauffeur who drove him, and I did not drive him during the campaigns.
Okay, when you drove Eisen, were those to make public appearances?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what types of groups would she address?
I really can't remember. Mm-hmm. She would get invitations, and I know, from time to time, and I can remember taking her to Milwaukee on at least one occasion. And then I remember I would drive him around town sometimes in the evening. It was generally evening driving that I would do, or else for her, when the regular chauffeur wasn't at work. And I remember among his confidants or friends, I guess social friends, were John Goss, who was a professor of political science, and Max Otto, who was a professor of philosophy. They were the two who I can remember who came frequently to their home. Now, one person you might talk to are the Rauschenbusches. Elizabeth Brandeis Rauschenbusch, she's the daughter of the Justice Brandeis, and Walter Rauschenbusch, both of them were professors of political science at the university.
Speaking of the university, your early political involvement was in university politics.
Yes.
Between a progressive club on campus, and there was a struggle between progressives and left-wing students. Could you elaborate
well,
on that?
Well, we decided that, well, there were two aspects of progressive involvement in politics. One was involvement in state politics, and for example, at our regular, I believe, monthly meetings, we would have different either legislators or congressmen or whoever. And my recollection is that we, on a number of occasions, had young Bob LaFollette as our speaker at the annual banquet. Tom Amley was greatly admired by the young Democrats, and he would speak at
young
one occasion.
Progressives.
Yeah, I'm talking about the young progressives on the campus. And Phil LaFollette, my recollection is, would speak too. And so we were involved in regular politics. By that I mean state politics and the congressmen and senators and the representatives of Wisconsin, either in the legislature or in Congress or the governor or the other offices. And then we were involved in campus politics. And we got involved in campus politics and organized an independent group. And the independent group took on the fraternities, and among the people who were elected were Jim Doyle and Ruth Doyle and an Udvar Haug from Stoughton, who were elected to the Cardinal Board. They put in an editor of the Cardinal, and then the new Cardinal Board, after the next election, fired the old editor, and then they had a big strike, and they had a strike edition for a long time. Did you get information on that?
Yes,
from somebody?
I have some.
Mm-hmm. And then I remember Bob Gunderson sought the election to the union board, and he ran on the issue of 6-cent hamburgers should be reduced back to 5 cents. And so when he won, they reduced the price of hamburgers back to a nickel. And then we used to hang around the Memorial Union a lot. It was sort of a hangout on certain tables for all the progressives or the people associated with the progressives. I remember in particular a fellow named Max Cishan, who Philip Fowler tried to get into law school, though he hadn't graduated from, or he didn't have the necessary requirements. He was a guy who was a farmer down in Walworth County, and they tried to foreclose on his mortgage, and they had to shoot him out of his farm when the sheriff tried to dispossess him. And his kid ran upstairs out of the basement, and at that point I remember he surrendered. And he was around the Memorial Union with all the rest of the progressives at that time. The two Stupar brothers from Milwaukee, who were attorneys. I think they're Milwaukee attorneys now. One of them was a champion boxer for the University of Wisconsin. There were a couple of others. And a fellow named Sonnenberg was another one who was very active at that time.
What motivated you personally to join the Progressive Club?
I think that unlike, as is frequently the case, most of the people were very involved in politics because they felt very strongly about political issues at that time. They strongly subscribed to the principles that the Progressive Party stood for. They were supporters of Roosevelt. They were supporters of Philip Follett. And part of it was that the Progressive Club was sort of a fraternity almost. That we would have, after each meeting, we'd either have lunch or beer or whatever, and when we had an annual beer picnic, I remember, and all of us would show up at the beer picnic and we'd have a great time together. We got to know each other, and we were much closer to the fellow members of the Progressive Club than we were to any other group on the campus. And I think it was the same kind of closeness that fraternity members have to each other. And that, plus the fact that we had almost a religious dedication in terms of the principles of the Progressive Party at that time. And if you'd gone and talked to the progressives, most of them would have been very well aware of the platform principles and would all believe in what was in the platform and so forth.
Okay. And you also mentioned you went out on during actual campaigns for the various candidates for progressives. You had mentioned when we talked earlier about 1934,
In 1934, before the primary and immediately after the convention when the Progressive Party was formed, I circulated the petitions, and I circulated several hundred petitions. As I recall, I had to get someone else's name because I wasn't on the as a circulator because I wasn't 21. And then I talked to somebody, and it was either Philip Follett or Bill Evue. I think it may have been Philip Follett, and I asked him what he could do. He said, why don't you put out a paper in Dane County? So I went to Bill Evue, who was the editor of the Capital Times, and Charlie Holmberg, who was his assistant, and they gave me an idea of what to do, and I went out and sold ads. First thing I did was to sell ads to every candidate on the Progressive ticket for $15. And my recollection is that it was a 2-column by maybe 10-inch ad that each person got for $15. And then we wrote the copy having to do with what the Progressive Party, different stories on what the Progressive Party stood for. And I remember I wrote the editorial that was used in the paper, and Charlie Holmberg wrote a lot of the stories, and then we made arrangements for it to be sent through the mail to all the box holders, and I'm not sure how it got distributed in Stoughton or Sun Prairie or wherever. But in Madison, we got a fellow to distribute it, and we paid him for distributing it. And he was one of the candidates for sheriff. Can't remember his name now. But at any rate, he distributed door to door to every house in Madison.
When you were distributing the petitions, do you remember if you use the appeal of the La Follette brothers or of the memory of Robert La Follette Sr., or was it the cause of the new Progressive Party?
In Stoughton, the lines were about as well drawn as they are in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants, except that in Stoughton, they were overwhelmingly La Follette progressives. And they all knew about the La Follette Progressive Party, and all I had to do was to ask them, would you sign a party for the formation of the new progressive, a petition for the new Progressive Party to be on the ballot. And it was not any great problem to get it done. Now, people who didn't want to sign it would let me know in no uncertain terms that they weren't for it.
Was there an ethnic division in Stoughton?
There were very few non-Norwegians in Stoughton. The original, or the background of old Bob La Follette and the La Follettes generally in Stoughton was there was a very strong attachment for the La Follettes. And as I said, people were either progressives, progressive Republicans, or stalwart Republicans, and they knew about it, and they were, you could ask a person who knew people generally, he would say, oh, he's a stalwart or he's a Republican. Well, you can't do that as much now anymore as you could in those days. But in those days, you took your stand one way or the other, and that was it. And the feelings were very strong. And the anger that would be generated between people was much greater than it is now, I think.
Were there any Democrats in the area, or was it pretty much split between the two factions of the Republican Party?
There were some Democrats, but not all that many, especially in Stoughton.
When you, later in your career, when you were finishing up the university, actually after you'd finished, you ran for city council in Madison?
Yeah.
And then, that was a nonpartisan office.
Yeah, in 1939.
Did you feel then you were still part of a progressive movement and part of the Progressive Party?
Well, there were a number. Norman Clapp and Annalise Clapp, his wife, helped me manage the campaign and helped me in the campaign by talking to their friends and neighbors. And the Capital Times endorsed me, and the State Journal openly opposed my election, said I was a carpetbagger from Stoughton. They didn't get into the political aspects, but really they knew I was a progressive because I, at that point, was the, it was later that I became the chairman of the Dane County Progressive Party.
Okay, when you were chairman of Dane County was one of the strongest counties in the state for the progressives.
That's correct.
It was probably the strongest. What was the composition of the party? What was its basis of support?
Well, they controlled the whole courthouse, so they had the public officials. The labor movement was attached to the Progressive Party. The greatest strength was in the farm country, and farmers generally considered themselves progressives. And then there were a lot of university people and people generally who I suppose you'd identify today as liberal, who at that time called themselves progressives. And especially up until 1937 or 38, there was not the division on foreign policy, but once the rumblings were taking place in Europe with Mussolini going into Ethiopia and Hitler's steps and so forth, and Bob La Follette being an isolationist, and the progressives, many of them being strong supporters of Roosevelt, there was a big division. That was probably one of the biggest divisions during the time before World War II that I saw, was a division between Bill Evio, for example, was a supporter of Roosevelt as opposed to the La Follettes, and was not very happy about, and was highly critical of the La Follette foreign policy stands, and both Bob and Phil La Follette were isolationists.
Okay. Even before that growing split in foreign policy, which was especially important in the Madison area for progressives, by 37 there was a split among statewide progressives between farm and labor groups.
You're talking now, I would guess, about the people who were members of the Farmer Labor Progressive Federation and people who were not members of it, but who were active in the Progressive Party. And Philip Follett, of course, never joined the Farmer Labor Progressive Federation. He was afraid that that would give him a basis of being tarred as being too radical. Well, Andy Biemiller, of course, and the labor people, the former socialists, also sprinkling the labor people all over the state, I should say, were really the backbone of the Progressive Farmer Labor Federation. Now, I think that maybe some of the farmers' union people were also active in the Progressive Farmer Labor Federation, but Philip Follett and the people most closely around him were very ginger about becoming too closely identified with the Progressive Farmer Labor Federation.
In addition to that, that organizational split, though, there was also, because of the competition between the AFL-affiliated unions and CIO-affiliated unions at the time, they were going into organizing previously unorganized workers, and this took a specific turn in a certain agricultural cooperatives, which angered farmers and caused some problems there. Okay, why don't we pick up with that? In the specific situation.
My recollection is that organized labor tried to organize the co-op. Truck drivers, weren't they, or somebody?
Was that a creamery?
Employees or creamery. Yeah, at the Richmond Center Creamery. And it created such a hullabaloo that the farm organizations divided. And the more liberal farm organizations became the Wisconsin Federation of Co-ops, and the other became the Wisconsin Council of Agriculture. And this continued for years, with which the Wisconsin Federation of Co-ops was the more closely identified with the Democrats, and the Wisconsin Council of Agriculture more closely identified with the Republicans.
Did that have impact on the progressives in Dane County during the late 30s and early 40s, or was it pretty much outstate?
I don't have any strong recollection of that.
Getting back to
Jack Kyle, though, would be a person who could give you a good deal of information on that score.
Yeah, he was very involved because of the co-ops. Okay. Another person I wanted to ask you about was the state senator from Madison early in the 30s, who was also a professor at the university, Harold Groves.
Yes.
And your impressions of the work that he did in the progressive organization.
Well, Harold Groves, as you know, was a professor of taxation in the Department of Economics at the university, and was sort of the godfather of progressive taxation theory, both in the university and in the legislature. And I took courses from him in the university, and I was not around that much to see how he functioned in the legislature.
Another event, you touched on Tom Amley earlier as being very popular with the young progressives. Do you have personal recollections of Amley and his role?
Well, Amley used to come to the university and give speeches, and he always spoke in favor of production for use and not for profit. And I'm not sure, I would guess he was a socialist. He probably was by far the most liberal person elected to Congress from Wisconsin during that era, and had a lot of very strong supporters and had a particular appeal to young people at the university.
Do you remember his appeal? In 1938, he ran for the Senate nomination on the progressive side. His opponent was Herman Eckern.
Herman Eckern, yeah.
Who represented the older, more traditional progressive.
Yeah.
Do you remember the impact of that election on the progressive club at the university?
No, I don't, but I would presume that most of the members of the club were for Tom Amley. And on the other hand, I think that Herman Eckern had this very wide acquaintanceship all over the state, having been active in politics in Wisconsin for so many years as an insurance commissioner and active in the progressive movement, that Eckern well, just by logic, have won that election, that primary.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about was the 1940 gubernatorial campaign of Paul Alfonsi, mm-hmm. where young progressives were among his strongest supporters. Mm-hmm. He ran against four other men for the nomination.
Right. And I was the assistant manager of Orland Loomis's campaign, and or at least I worked with Maury Pasch, who managed Orland Loomis's campaign, and Harold Stafford was the third, and let's see, who was the fourth?
Philip Nelson was
the Phil Nelson from Portage.
From Superior. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There was one more person.
Yeah, the Gunderson was from Portage, who was lieutenant governor at about that time, and then Phil Nelson, as you know, was a Republican until 1936. And he was one of them. He and Zimney, Art Zimney, were the two who Duncan and Philip Follett wooed over to the progressive camp. Zimney from Milwaukee, a Democrat, and Nelson from Superior, a Republican.
Another event in the 40s, this may have been occurring after you joined the Army, progressives began to file under both sides. I'm thinking specifically of Senator Allen Busby, mm-hmm. who filed for both the Republican and progressive nominations and eventually took office as a Republican. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the effect that had on progressives?
No, I don't. I was not here at that time.
But that was in 1942, I believe. So I guess the final question I'd like to ask you here is...
I went in the Army in September of 42. No, in August of 42.
August of 42.
Yeah.
So you would have been gone by that time.
Yeah.
You were gone for the rest of the progressive party's life.
Yeah, from there until 46. I came out in 46 when I was told that Philip Follett had it in the bag, or rather, young Bob Follett had it in the bag, and I really didn't need to do anything but go on a vacation out to New York State. And I would not have made the difference, but I and other people who might have been told the same thing probably did make the difference. And of course, the big factor was that Bob LaFont never came back to Wisconsin and didn't keep in close touch with... In other words, if Bob LaFont had had 10% of the personal contact with the voters that Bill Proxmire has, no question about it, he would have won.
But he was not a person who liked to press the flesh.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any contact with Phil LaFont then? The following years.
I did not. I think that when I came home, worked for Bob, he may or may not have been aware of that, but I think he was very critical of our activities in going into the Democratic Party and working, and he, you know, had been very close to MacArthur and pushed the MacArthur candidacy, and he, at no time when I sought the governorship or the congressional race, did he do anything to help me?
Okay, end the tape here. Yeah, I just started to ask you about Glenn Roberts.
Glenn Roberts was very close to the LaFollettes. In fact, it was said that during that early period that if a person wanted to get any special ear out of Washington, the best way to do it was to hire Glenn Roberts as an attorney. And of course, he was Philip Follett's law partner.
Right. Okay. The final question is a little philosophical as to why you decided to join the Democratic Party when you returned to Wisconsin rather than follow Bob LaFollette into the Republican Party.
I voted in the Republican primary of 1946. When he was defeated in the primary, I saw nothing left in the Republican Party that would interest me at all. And so I went over and managed Bill Rice's campaign. Bill Rice was a law professor at the university, and he ran for Congress. And I was asked by Andy Biemiller and Bob Tien to manage the campaign. And so I went back and forth on the train from Stoughton to Madison every day and managed the campaign. And then shortly after the election was over, when Bob Henry defeated Bill Rice, Bob Henry died. And they called a special election, and I was persuaded to be the candidate. And incidentally, out of over 100,000 votes cast, I lost by 800 or 900 votes. And if it had not been for a strike, it's quite an interesting commentary. The telephone workers went on strike, and they closed down every place except Waukesha County, which had automatic dialing. And so Glenn Davis was my opponent. And that, I think, was the greatest single factor in my defeat. And not only that, but we really hadn't learned the art of getting out in the other counties other than Dane and Waukesha County to reach the Democrats out there. And if we had done the kinds of things that Tim Cullen, for example, does in a new district, although we didn't have an awful lot of time, but all these people could have been successful. I remember, for example, in Horicon, they had a labor meeting, and I went to Horicon the night before election or whenever it was and gave a speech to the employees of the union. And in that whole area around there, I lost every precinct except in Horicon, and I won Horicon, as I recall, 2-1, just because I was able to get in and make a speech to the employees of the union. But the other was not a question of Carl Thompson being liked or disliked or whatever, Carl Thompson being unknown. It was very similar to the fact that in 48, when I was a candidate for governor during the Truman campaign. After the campaign was over, Eddie Mertz, who was a representative from Milwaukee, was hunting up north. And he had a bunch of northern Wisconsin hunters there, and he asked them who they were for governor in the last campaign. And they said, who the hell was running beside Rennebaum? And so if you don't have any money in a campaign, and if you aren't known, then it is very, very difficult to get votes. And this was the case in that early period, too. And although some of these that's one of the reasons why I think Philip Ouellette was the logical candidate in 1934. Nobody else was well enough known to be a candidate. And of course, Kohler and Rennebaum both spent an awful lot of money when they sought office, both the senior Kohler and the younger Kohler.
That's one of the things that stands out in the progressive campaigns, is that the small amount of money that was spent, and yet the amount of time they were able to campaign in person and make personal appearances.
And of course, in those days, Philip Ouellette would make speeches and get 4, 5, 6, 8, 1,200 people at a rally. And the night before the regular election, they'd fill the field house.
Was that, have you ever seen that in the 40s and 50s?
No.
Was the war
nothing?
The turning point? Then people didn't?
Television was the big factor, I think, when that finally came. When people had other things to do, I think that was more than anything else. My campaign consisted, when I ran for governor, both in 48 and 50, I had big platform trucks with loudspeakers on them, and I spoke on street corners all over the state. But time after time, I'd come in and have just a handful of people. But generally, the newspapers would write some kind of a story about my appearance in the county, although I can't remember that as well, and I know you aren't writing now about the start of the Democratic Party, you're writing about the Progressive Party. But there's some of the people who would have more information on that than I would, because they were reading it, either John Moses in one campaign or Jim Doyle in the other.
Okay. One final aspect of the division between Democrat and Republican after the Progressives split up, do you think that had anything to do with the division over Franklin Roosevelt's foreign policy?
In part.
Because I know Tom Amley, who supported that foreign policy, became a Democrat in the early 40s and ran for Congress in 41 as a Democrat, and the Folletts both deposed and returned to the Republican Party.
I'm sure it did have a lot to do with it. I think there were two things. Number one, the foreign policy, and number two, the Folletts' assessment that things were not ripe yet for running on the Democratic ticket. In fact, in one recent book that I read on Joe McCarthy, I think that Bob La Follette was interviewed in which he indicated that there was no chance on the Democratic ticket. I stopped in Washington sometime in 1946 and talked to Bob. This is before he had decided, maybe it was in 45, before he had decided what he was going to do. And he asked me what I thought, and I said, well, I didn't know that I'd been away in the Army, and how did I know, you know, where his best chances were? And I sort of indicated to him that I thought there was a great danger of his being defeated in the Republican primary, that I was very fearful in view of the terrible vote that the progressives had in 1944, if he ran on the progressive ticket, that he probably could get the nomination in 1946 on the Democratic ticket. And so I think that at least he discussed with me the alternatives. So it was not something that he just blindly decided I'm going to run as a Republican. But at least with me, he made that discussion. And I, at that time, was not identified with the Democrats, so he was thinking about it.
Because there apparently was division between the brothers over that. Mm-hmm. Is that Phil wanted to remain a progressive, to keep the Progressive Party going. Mm-hmm.
Even in 46?
In 46. Mm-hmm. Gordon Sinekin had to talk Phil out of going to the Portage Convention so that there would not be public disagreement mm-hmm. between the two. Mm-hmm.
Did he think he made a mistake?
In his autobiography, he calls it a mistake.
No, Gordon Sinekin?
Oh. He didn't express an opinion on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.